1 Kings chapter 11, we started into this last week, and we started a week ago by reading verses 1 through 10, really to establish the context of what's going on in this chapter. And we mentioned at the time that the material that's in 1 Kings chapter 11 is found exclusively right here in this chapter. Now, of course, some of these events we see mentioned or described in other places in God's Word, which we want to look at, but the details of what happened to Solomon at this point, where he fell away from the Lord, fell into idolatry and sinned against God, and then he's going to face punishment for that. We know that ultimately he repented of those things, as we have the book of Ecclesiastes recorded for us, and very important that we have that. But at any rate, we don't have anything in 2 Chronicles to follow along with this chapter. As we've had almost, really all the chapters up to now in 1 Kings, we've been following along in 2 Chronicles as the material parallels there. This is a standalone chapter, though. It's really only here that we read about these things in detail. So we want to continue that this morning, but we also want to read those first 10 verses again, just to refresh, and we've gotten started into some of the points about this, but we need to continue on with that, so it may be helpful to read that text again here as we begin. And Brother Stephen, can you read for us from 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 10?
King Solomon loved many strange women together with the daughters of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. Of the nation concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon played unto these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wife turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord, the God, as was the heart of David, his father. Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord, as David, his father. Then did Solomon build a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. And likewise did he for all his strange wives, which burnt incense and sacrificed unto the gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart was not turned from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice, and had condemned him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods, but he kept not that which the Lord commanded.
All right, so it's sad to read this, what happens to Solomon at this point in his life. And but this, what he tells us about Solomon here is a very important body of material for us to know, to understand, and to learn from, because the things that happen to Solomon there are a danger for people today, and it can be for us individually, or we all have responsibilities towards our families and our spiritual family in the congregation. So that means all of our young people are of great concern to us, as we love them. And so even if we're beyond the point where we may have some direct application for some of these things, well, there are still going to be some principles in there that we all need to keep in mind for ourselves. But a lot of those things, it may be for the generation that's coming after us. But however it applies, we need to know what God intends for us to know and understand from this, and make sure that we listen and follow what he says. Because as we have considered, especially with the previous chapter, when it detailed or reminded us again of that great wisdom that God gave to Solomon, if Solomon could have his heart turned away from the Lord, if Satan could get Solomon with all the wisdom that he had, who among us wants to say, well, I'm wiser than Solomon? That would not be a very comfortable position for us to take. If the devil could get Solomon with his wisdom, can he get us? I mean, that's really a big question from that, which we know the answer to, yes. So seeing what happened to Solomon, that from a certain standpoint, of course, that's pretty scary, because we can see, well, the devil is going to be looking for our weak spot. Well, let's find out what those weak spots were there, make sure we don't have the same ones or any other ones. So he starts there by saying that King Solomon loved many strange women. Now, I'm sure if you were to ask Ashara, she could probably tell you she married a strange man. But this is not the way that this is not strange in the sense that we might typically use the word today. He doesn't mean having quirks or being a little bit weird. Maybe a half a bubble off a plum or something, but at any rate, this is talking. What does that word mean? That word strange. Foreign. That's what that means. They were not Israelites, and that's very clear from the context of that verse and what follows, as he says, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of, and he names these nations, and it's interesting, he starts with the Moabites and Ammonites, and then mentions some, those other neighboring nations that Solomon married women from. Now, why is that significant? Well, verse 2. What does he say there? What was the problem with that? Number one, God had told them not to do that. Had told them specifically or explicitly told them not to marry women of those nations. Now, God also gave a reason for it. And those that are in here that are parents or grandparents, or we all have had experience where we have given a... Of course, we were all children one time, too, so we know we did this. A commandment comes, do this or don't do that. And what follows, especially when children start getting a little bit older... Why? Why do I have to do that? Or why can't I do that? Now, do we have to have a reason if God tells us something? Is he required to give us a reason for all of his commandments? Okay, here's why I'm telling you not to do this. Or here's why I'm telling you to do this. Is it enough or should it be enough if God says do this or don't do that, that we would do or don't do whatever it is that he's telling us? And it would be good for our children to do the same. It would have been good if we'd all did that ourselves when we were children, as we should. But we need to think about it. We are God's children. How are we treating God? Do we accept what he says and follow that? Or do we want to get into an argument? Do we have to have, in our own minds, be satisfied that there's a good enough reason in order for us to do what God says? Well, why do we need to do what God says? We must not ever forget that point. Is it because he convinces us with logic that whatever he's saying fits in with what we're thinking? Is that why we need to obey the Lord? He made us, exactly. So he has that authority as creator. Now, whatever he tells us to do from that authority, I mean, it's never going to change the fact that he's the maker, he's the creator, and we're part of the creation. He made us. So we don't have to have a reason for everything if God tells us here to do that. So when he told the Israelites, don't marry women from these nations, if he had just said that period and said nothing else about it, should that have been enough? It should have. But now... God went much beyond that, as he does in his word. He doesn't just give us a collection of commandments, do this, or thou shalt, or thou shalt not. God does teach us in his word, and he wants us to understand his nature. And therefore, he typically will give us teaching with his commandments, why we should and shouldn't do things. And so that's very kind of God to teach us like that so we can understand Him. And what's the point of being able to understand Him and know Him? So we can be like Him. If all we had was a collection of commandments and the teaching wasn't there, where we could see, okay, here's the heart of God. Here's the very nature of God. That would make it far more difficult for us to be able to have the same heart in us, to be partakers of that divine nature. So God gives us those commandments. He teaches us, though, why He's telling us those things. With the commandment here that He gave to the Israelites that He's mentioning, when He told them not to marry women of those nations, He told them exactly why they shouldn't. What would happen if they did?
They would turn away His heart.
Yeah, they would. Their hearts would be turned away from God to the idols that those nations worshiped. When we look at the Old Testament, there was that physical nation of Israel, and they were distinct from their in their genealogy from the other nations. They were descended from Abraham through Isaac through Jacob. Now, Abraham had other descendants through Ishmael. Were those the children of the promise? No. Isaac had other children through Esau, Jacob's twin brother. Were they children of the promise? Those are the Edomites. In fact, they're mentioned right there in verse 1. But were they the children of the promise? They were not. It was from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. And only those descendants of Jacob through his 12 sons, the tribes of Israel. That was the physical nation of Israel, the nation with whom God made that covenant. So there was a physical distinction between the nation of Israel and those other nations. Now, was God making that distinction based, when He's giving these commandments, don't marry these other women or men from these other nations? Was it strictly because of some physical reason, some outward reason, some racial reason or ethnic reason? The reason that God made that distinction was itself based on a spiritual distinction between His people and those other nations. What was wrong with the people from those other nations? Was it just because of they had the wrong genealogy? Well, we know better than that, because were there people, did God try to work with people from those other nations? He certainly did. That was a lesson He taught Jonah, isn't it? When He sent Jonah to Nineveh and to preach His word to them. What was the reason Jonah disobeyed the Lord, and when God said go east, that he went due west instead? That's right. That's what he told. When you get to the end of the first chapter of Jonah, is when God gives him the commandment to go to Nineveh to preach. And then Jonah hops a boat heading to Tarshish, which is where in Spain. So he goes heading on a boat to go as far as you could go at that time, due west, when God wanted him to go due east. So he didn't just... I mean, if he just sat still where he was, that would have been not obeying the commandment of God. But he not only didn't obey it, He very vigorously did as much of the opposite of what God told him to do as he could. He wanted to get as far away from Nineveh as he possibly could get. He didn't feel safe enough just where he was sitting in Israel, and not going at all. He wanted to put as much distance between himself and Nineveh as he possibly could, as much as was possible at that time, and he failed. Chapter 2 tells about Jonah's repentance when he was in the belly of that fish that swallowed him at the end of chapter 1. So then in chapter 3, he goes to Nineveh and he preaches like God intended from the beginning. And he preaches, and what do the people of Nineveh do?
They repent.
And then God changes his mind about the destruction that he was going to bring upon them. What was the sermon that he sent Jonah to preach? 40 days and Nineveh will be destroyed. And if you read that, it wasn't, unless you repent and then I won't. It was, in 40 days Nineveh will be destroyed. Did God have in his mind the intention to destroy Nineveh within 40 days because of how great their wickedness was? Absolutely. And Jonah knew that. And that's why Jonah, in his mind, he's obviously thinking, if I get over there, if I make it to Tarshish, there's no way that I'm going to get back to be over in Nineveh within 40 days and they're done for. That's what he was thinking. He says that at the beginning of chapter 4. He was mad when the people of Nineveh repented. He sat there and was watching, hopeful to see the destruction. So he got himself at a safe enough distance, but close enough to see it, but far enough away where he wouldn't get caught up in it, but wanted to see whatever God was going to do to utterly destroy them. Jonah obviously didn't like those people, did he? They were a threat to Israel. So Jonah's reason for why he would have they were a rising power. I mean, they became the world empire in their day. So they were on the ascendancy at that time, rising to be what they became. And what was Jonah's feelings about the nation borne out over time that they were a threat to Israel? Well, who was it that destroyed the northern kingdom and took all those tribes into captivity where they never returned? Who was it that flooded through the southern kingdom of Judah after that? Where in Isaiah you can read it describes in the prophecy they were going to rise up like a flood from its banks up to their neck. But then God was going to make the waters recede. Well, they came and took all the fenced cities of Judah until only Jerusalem was left, literally an island in Judah. So at that point, they had all of Israel, all the territory of Israel except for that last bastion, the city of Jerusalem, where Hezekiah was holed up with the remnant. And then God, because of Hezekiah's righteousness, God spared Jerusalem at his time. And that's when he sent his angel, and there were the army of the Assyrians were smitten in their field, and they fled back to their land. But that was all the Assyrians that did all that. So what Jonah was seeing as a threat to Israel, I mean, it was real, and time showed that. But that generation, interestingly, if you read the book of the prophet Nahum, what's the central point of the book of Nahum? It's about Nineveh and its destruction. It's interesting, two of the books of the minor prophets, two of the 12 are about Nineveh being destroyed. But they were written about 100 years apart. Jonah versus Nahum. The generation in Jonah's time repented. But here Assyria was at its zenith in Nahum's time. And God's foretelling their destruction. That generation was not repentant. And who was it that God used to destroy the empire of Assyria? Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians. Battle of Carchemish, 605 B.C. That was the big battle where Babylon defeated Assyria, and that was the end of that empire. But Nahum prophesied about that. That generation didn't repent. So just because one generation didn't mean that they all would. Well, how many times that happened in Israel when you had a generation that, when they were had fallen into wickedness and a generation would repent? Did that mean that the next generation was going to follow the Lord? Well, look at the cycle of the book of Judges. I mean, that's what happened, and they would turn away from the Lord again. So that same pattern was shown with the people of Nineveh and Assyria. But the ones that were in Jonah's time did listen. They repented. Jonah wanted them destroyed. And then God taught him a lesson when he made that vehement east wind come and made it just about unbearably hot, where Jonah was sitting to watch where he was hoping to watch the big show. And then God made a gourd grow to give him shade, and then made the sent a worm to eat the gourd. It withered and died, and Jonah was blasted with the heat. And so then God taught him a lesson. Here you cared about this gourd that you didn't do any work for, didn't make it, and Shall I not care for all these people in Nineveh that I made? So he was teaching Jonah a lesson there, and that teaches us, though, but it's a demonstration of how God did work with the people of those other nations. I mean, look at other ones. Nebuchadnezzar, we mentioned him a minute ago. Did God work with Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon? Look at how much he did and how he taught him those lessons. That's all recorded in the book of Daniel. There were others. I mean, people that were not Israelites physically, that were righteous, that God showed mercy to. Ever heard of Rahab? Ever heard of Ruth? I mean, we could go on and on with examples of that and how God was working with those other nations. The Empire of Persia in Esther's time, as that book records, there were a lot of people that were converted to following Jehovah and became Jews because of what God did using Esther and sparing the people of Israel. So there are lots of examples of that. The fact that there was a distinction between Israel and the other nations of the world didn't mean that God did not love the souls of those other nations and was working with them. He was trying to save them too. But he had a covenant only with Israel. That special covenant that he made. And there was a spiritual distinction between Israel and those other nations, with those exceptions that we mentioned. But what were spiritually or religiously, what did those other nations do? They worshipped idols, didn't they? And that's what he was mentioning there. That was the basis of that commandment for them to not marry the women of those other nations. And last week we looked at several passages. For example, we read from Deuteronomy chapter 7, from the first verse of that chapter, where God gave that commandment for them not only not to marry the sons or daughters of those nations, but what did he tell them to do with the people of those other nations that they were taking in Canaan? Yes, utterly destroy them. He pronounced a death sentence on those nations, those neighbors of Israel. With some exceptions, who did he specifically command Israel not to utterly destroy? And why? Can read it, but those three, Moab, Ammon, and Edom. Now they did not, they refused to help Israel when they were coming up on the east side of the Jordan rivers. They came up out of the wilderness. They came up to the east, and then ultimately they crossed the Jordan River, and after conquering the land on the east side, they conquered the land, the territory of Sihon and Og, Gilead and Bashan. They conquered those areas, all that territory to the north of those three nations, Moab, Ammon, and Edom. Between them and Syria, God gave that territory to Israel. They conquered that first. Then they crossed the Jordan River, took Jericho and Ai, and then city after city until they conquered all that territory on the west side of the Jordan River. But those nations that occupied that land, God told them to utterly destroy them. Not to marry them, not even to let them remain alive. Now, did the Israelites do a great job of obeying that? No. And the pockets of the survivors that they allowed remain there, he describes that particularly in the first two chapters of the book of Judges. But we also read last week from Joshua 23:11-13, when God told them that if they didn't obey that commandment of his, then that God would ultimately not drive them out for them. And that ended up happening. And so Judges, first three chapters of Judges, God made that decision as he had told him, that he would not drive out those remnants of those nations because they had not obeyed, and he was going to leave them to be thorns in their sides. But again, and we read from Judges 3 last week, he commanded them not to marry the sons or daughters of those nations, and gave the reason again, just like he had in Deuteronomy 7. Why didn't he include Moab, Ammon, and Edom with the death sentence? And that's what it was. Utter destruction for the other nations, the ones whose territory that he was giving Israel to. But he would not allow Israel to take the territory. He would not, he forbade them from utterly destroying those three nations and said, you will not take their territory, because God had given the land that they had as an inheritance to them, because Moab and Ammon were the descendants of... Yes. I know she meant Lot. Then Edom from Esau. So he had given their territory to those nations. That was their inheritance. God regarded Lot. He was a righteous man, and so God had made a determination. He was going to give an inheritance to his descendants. Does that mean they were righteous? No. And did God bring punishment on them himself? Yes, and he did bring destruction on them and Edom. So they were wicked nations, but God told Israel, you can't take their inheritance. He wasn't going to let them take Israel's inheritance, but he wouldn't let Israel take theirs either. So that was an exception. However, what did we also read last week from Deuteronomy 23 about those nations? It was a little different than what he said about the ones that the native Canaanite peoples, the Amorites in Deuteronomy 7. From Deuteronomy 23, we read verse 3 last week. He told them not to marry any of the women from those nations either. Not that they should utterly destroy those people, but don't marry them. Well, because they were wicked too. And then he particularly cited the fact that they would not help them when they were coming up through their land. And so he would not allow any association between Israel and those nations, including marriages. And again, that spiritual reason is behind that. So he includes that there. So we have from Deuteronomy 7, those nations that were to be utterly destroyed, certainly not married, because of who they were spiritually. And then the ones in Deuteronomy 23, what God said about them, because of, again, their wickedness. So a different commandment that God gave to Israel regarding how to treat the people from those nations. The common part was don't marry. But there shouldn't have been anybody left to marry from those nations, seven nations that were within Canaan itself, that God told them to take their territory and leave none alive. That was part of the reason why God left them in Egypt for 400 years. There were a couple things going on there. God, over time, was fulfilling his promise to make Abraham's descendants through Isaac and Jacob to be as the sand of the seashore and the stars of the sky for multitude. That was one of the promises that he had made, that he was keeping. And while they were in Egypt, they multiplied to that point. So he was fulfilling that promise while they were still in Egypt. Then he brought them out, of course, to give them the land, which was another promise that he made, that land of Canaan. But there was a reason why during that period of time, I mean, could he have put them somewhere else while he was working on them to grow their numbers? Sure, he could have had them somewhere else other than Egypt. But he told Abraham in that prophecy in Genesis 15, he was going to have them in that land where they would be oppressed for 400 years. But one of the reasons why he had to hold them somewhere else and not give them Canaan at that time was what? What was not yet full or complete? The wickedness of the Amorites. See, if he had... Now, could he have taken... How many souls went down into Israel at the time when Joseph was made governor there under Pharaoh? And Jacob and his children and the grandchildren they had at that time, what was the total number of souls that went into Egypt there from the very start? 70. So 70 people. Was that just too few for God to have been able to give them Canaan, all that land of Canaan at that time? No. If God had determined that he wanted them to inherit the land at that time, he could have given them Canaan first and then grown their numbers, couldn't he have? He wasn't unable, not at all. But there was a reason for the order. But part of that, or a big part of that, was what he said in Genesis 15. The wickedness of the Amorites was not yet full. If he was going to have those people utterly destroyed and dispossessed of their land, then if they had to be worthy of that punishment, didn't they? Because that was the ultimate punishment, utter destruction. So he gave that sentence upon them when their wickedness was full. So they were, and it's interesting to see, they were on a downhill. They were already wicked in Genesis. But if you'd asked me, if I'd been back in Abraham's time when God spoke those words, and if somehow I'd been alive and when you get to Moses and Joshua's time, I don't know that I would have been able to see much difference. Wicked seems wicked. But of course, we can tell. I think just about every one of us in this room that can understand the words that I'm speaking right now have lived long enough where we can tell that the world that we live in, it hasn't stayed the same. Anybody here think the world is exactly the same as it was 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, 30 years ago or more? I mean, it's changed a lot in a very short amount of time. Anybody here think it's gotten better spiritually? No, not at all. We know things are getting worse. It's getting worse by the day. It's getting more and more wicked. So can things just because, I mean, when is the world ever righteous? 1 John 5:19 says the whole world lieth in wickedness. It does. I mean, if we want to start looking for, 50 years ago the world was righteous. No, it wasn't. It wasn't as wicked as it is now, but it was still wicked. But are there degrees in can wickedness progress and can it reach a point of completion? Yes, and that was what he said about the Amorites there in Canaan. And that's what happened to them. Are you able to discern when that point is reached in an individual or a nation or the world as a whole? I can't. I question that sometimes. Well, how bad can it get? How low is low? Well, it's safe to say, I believe right now, we're not there yet. I don't want us to get there yet. And we're told in 1 Timothy 2 to pray for our authorities. If you have the wickedness of the world, if it sinks so low where it's just complete, like in Noah's time where the imagination of everyone's heart is only evil continually, does that sound like a wickedness that was full? When the imaginations of the hearts of the people, everybody, is only evil continually. And that's there. That was in Noah's time, the whole world. Well, that's where those people, Sodom and Gomorrah got there. The Amorites got there. And God did with all of them the same thing. They were worthy of the ultimate punishment. If we reach that point here in our land or in our world, how easy is it going to be for us to live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty? Well, look at what Lot was in Sodom and Gomorrah. When he was in Sodom there, how well was he doing at living a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty? Two angels come to his house and then they're all en masse at the door, pounding on the door, demanding that they have those two men. I mean, is that quiet and peaceable when you can't even have somebody to come to your house without them being dragged and what they were going to do? I mean, that's horrible. That's how bad it got. That's when the imagination of the heart is only evil continually. We're not there yet. We don't want to get there, and we're told to pray for our authority so it doesn't get like that. We want God to hear our prayer for that so that we can live those kinds of lives, that we're not jeopardized from living the kinds of lives that God intends for us to live and being the light of the world and being able to work with each other and build each other up so we can be like Christ. And have the opportunity to try to convert others to Christ as well so that they can then be able to run that same race that we're running. We need to pray for that. But there was a reason why God gave that sentence upon those nations and particularly told them, don't marry these women or these men. They're going to turn your heart away. If they're wicked like that, you marry them, what's going to happen? You'll be corrupted. That was the reason that God gave. And he's bringing that up there in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 2, giving that reminder of what he had said and why he had said it. And Solomon, he didn't listen to the commandment that God gave in Deuteronomy 7. He didn't listen to the commandment he gave in Deuteronomy 23 about the Ammonites, Moabites, those nations, that they weren't to utterly destroy, but they were to not have any part of. He married the women from them too. He also ignored the commandment that we looked at last week in Deuteronomy 17. What was that chapter, the last half of that chapter about? The kings that Israel would eventually have. And did that mean that God thought that was a good idea? God had ordained judges for them. When was the first time that Israel tried to get a king? Anybody remember? Who would have been Israel's first king if that one had gone along with the will of the people? You might argue, well, they wanted to appoint a captain to lead them back to Egypt in Moses and Joshua and Caleb's time. But if that had succeeded and they'd gone back to Egypt, they wouldn't have had a king there except for Pharaoh. So we won't count that. Gideon. They tried to make Gideon king after that he had led them to victory over the Midianites and Ammonites. Amalekites. Which, think about that one. The whole point of what God did with that, with Gideon defeating those nations with only how many men? 300. Was so that no one could credit man with that, but they would know it was God. And so as soon as it's over, what do they do? Well, let's make Gideon king if he could do that. That's sad, isn't it? But Gideon refused. He said, you will have no king but God. Then Gideon died, and what does one of his sons do? Abimelech makes himself king. And that's what Judges chapter 9 is about. And with the assistance of the people of Shechem, which was the hometown of his mother. And he killed all of his brothers, the other 70 sons of Gideon, except for one who survived. But he, since Gideon wouldn't be king, he said, well, I'll just make myself to be king. That failed. So then they maintained their judges for the rest of their time until you get to Samuel's day. And then they demand to have a king like the nations around them. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, God says, told Samuel, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected me from being king over them. So was that God's plan? No, God's plan was for them to have those judges where God would choose each generation the most righteous person that they would have in the nation to lead them. What better system is that than there is there than that? And were they of the same family, same tribe? No, God, you can look at the variety of people that He chose as the judges. Who was their first leader? Moses, who was from Levi. Who was the second one? Joshua. He was from the tribe of Ephraim. The next judge was Othniel, the nephew of Caleb, from the tribe of Judah. The next one after that was Ehud, the left-handed Benjamite. And then we read about, well, Gideon was another one. He was from Manasseh. Jephthah was also from Manasseh. Samson was from Dan. Samuel was from Levi. I mean, you have all kinds of different tribes represented at different times, not from the same families, but God was choosing, he would choose the best. It wouldn't matter which tribe they were from or which family they were from. He would choose the most righteous one to lead them. What better system could you have? And then they say, I want a king. We want to have a king like the rest of the nations. And then that system forces you to, well, when one leader dies, who do you get? The best? Or do you get the son and hope it's the best? And how often was it the best? David and Solomon, that combination, that's about the only time that worked that way, really, isn't it? So anyway, it wasn't the best system for them at all. But did God know that they would end up demanding that? And did God anticipate that he would say, okay, that's what you want here. You can have it, and here's what you're going to get with it. Which is what ended up happening. But so God was anticipating that at the time when he gave their law through Moses, that was going to happen. I mean, it took about 1,000 years for it to, about 500, between 400 and 500 years, for that to end up coming about. But it did. But God gave commandments in Deuteronomy 17 for when they did have a king, what the kings should and shouldn't do. But among those commandments, what did he say about those wives? Like with horses. Don't multiply. He told them not to multiply horses because he didn't want them to be tied to Egypt. There was a spiritual reason for that. That land of their bondage. The wickedness of that nation. But he told them not to multiply wives to themselves. Again, going along with all of this. What it would do to them spiritually. So Solomon had all those commandments. Those different passages in Deuteronomy and other places. And the examples of when the Israelites had done those things. And we look at Judges chapters 2 and 3 last week, the example of what happened after Joshua in Israel. What happened to that generation after Joshua and the elders of Israel that lived in their time when they were following the Lord? And God blessed them tremendously with all the land of Canaan, to the fullest extent of the boundaries that he had promised, and he did not leave anything of the promises that he had made undone to that generation because they obeyed the Lord. Their fathers had not. They were the ones that died in the wilderness after wandering 40 years, some sooner than others, but they all died out as God promised. But the next generation, Joshua's, that generation went in, they obeyed the Lord, they were blessed for it, but what happened to their children? They went astray because they didn't know. And remember those 2 points that we were looking at there, those 2 big points about how that they lost their children because they hadn't taught their children to know God and what he had done like they should have. So they didn't know those things about God like they needed to. And then secondly, they married those men and women from those other nations that God told them not to do, and they turned their hearts away from the Lord. Did Solomon have that example to go by? To remember from. So he not only had the commandment and the reason for the commandment not to marry those people, those women, but he also had the examples of when God's people had disobeyed the commandment and what happened to them for it. What about the big one we looked at in Genesis 6? We've already referred to the time of Noah. What caused the world to get to that point where the thoughts of the imaginations of the hearts of men, the thoughts of their hearts were only evil continually? How did they get that bad? The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair. They married them because of the way they looked, not because of the kind of heart they had. Does that mean all the righteous girls were ugly? No, but they obviously had the wrong priorities, didn't they? So they married on the wrong basis, physical reasons, not spiritual reasons. And what did it do to their children? I mean, it doesn't say whether those doesn't look too great for the ones who made that, had that as the basis of their decision. But we can look at Solomon. This wasn't great. This was terrible what he did. And it almost cost him his soul, but it didn't. He was able to recover himself. He repented. Did any of those sons of God that married those God's children that married those daughters of the world of men, did any of them get through with that with their souls intact? Entirely possible. But what happened to their children? They didn't convert their wives, and here their children are growing up with that mixture there, and they're exposed to the world. We hope the fathers taught them about God and tried anyway, but what happened? They lost their children. Yes.
Just going to comment, we have that command today. It's like not unequally yoked with unbelievers. So, that, of course, marriage is the ultimate method of yoking, but there's many, many other forms of being yoked together. And, we have the equivalent command today that we're together.
No, we're not. I also like, and that's why we're doing this, because this has a, there's a point to this. There's a reason we're harping on this, and we're going to keep harping on this, Lord willing. The Lord is harping on it, and He wants us to. Anything that was able to destroy the entire world within that short of time, like it did in Noah's time, anything that would do to a man as wise as Solomon what it did, this is huge. This is absolutely huge. This will destroy us, our families, the church, all of that, if we don't listen to this. This is one of the biggest things. I mean, what is the biggest decision? What's the biggest decision that a person makes in their entire life? That's number one. And every other decision, if the right decision is made with that one, every other decision is going to be formed on that basis and will then be the right decision from there. But what will be the next biggest decision that will be a subset of that one? Who you spend your life with, who you're going to marry. Now, of course, if you've made the first decision right, and that's what this is, then you should make the next one right. But if you make the first decision right, then blow the second one, what's it going to do to your life, and what's it going to do to your children, and what's it going to do to your grandchildren, what's going to end up happening? I mean, that's what the warning is about. Why do I have 2 Timothy? 2 Corinthians 6, 14 through 18, that's the passage that Brother Jan was making reference to when he said to be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. What communion does light have with darkness? Does righteousness have with unrighteousness? Does the temple of God with idols? Does Christ with Belial? There's no fellowship there. These are things that are opposite. They don't belong together. And did you ever take those tests in school, you know, when they're testing your smarts, and then you have these things, what does not belong in this set or something, or what doesn't go together here? And they give you those questions. You're supposed to be able to discern, okay, yeah, these things go together, that one doesn't. Well, when we're reading 2 Corinthians 6, and if we apply that, that is a general teaching. It has lots of applications in our lives. Does it apply? I mean, is it specifically about marriage? That context is not. Does it apply? Well, yeah, you can't obey that commandment in 2 Corinthians 6 and then marry an unbeliever, can you? I mean, how could you be more yoked together with an unbeliever than when you marry him? So there's no way you can obey that commandment and then marry an unbeliever. What is the standard of belief? That's one reason to have 2 Timothy 2:2 up there. I think we have time for this before we are done for the morning. Brother Ted, can you read that for us? 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2. Mention marriage or anything there. Well, it doesn't mention marriage in 2 Corinthians 6. It doesn't mention marriage here either, but there's a principle involved. Here's the principle about when we are working with others to be able to, in this context, someone that's going to be sent out to teach others, to teach and preach and live the gospel of Christ. Now we can see the pattern that Paul the Apostle followed when it outlines that in Acts 19, when he went to Ephesus and he taught in the school of Tyrannus for 2 years. What did he do there? Well, we have examples of how he did that with Epaphras, who as one, he took that. Paul taught those ones in the school of Tyrannus, and then it says that within 2 years, everyone in that whole Roman province of Asia Minor had heard the gospel during that time. Well, Paul didn't go to every town, every village in that province. He stayed right there in Ephesus, the capital of it. But he had faithful men there, like Epaphras and others. that he taught those things to, and then they went out and taught others those things. Well, Timothy, he left in Ephesus. This is after Paul's first imprisonment in Rome. He wanted that work that he had spent those 3 years doing in Ephesus on his last missionary journey just before his imprisonment. But he put Timothy, or sent Timothy, to Ephesus to continue on with that work. And here he's reminding Timothy of how to continue doing that work, as Paul was facing his death and he wanted it to go on after his death. But what was he telling Timothy to do? The same thing. What Paul had done, what Timothy had been doing. In fact, Paul did this with Timothy. I mean, Timothy was an example of this. Why did Paul, or the Lord through Paul, put Timothy in Ephesus to be the one to carry that work on? What does the book of Philippians say about Timothy? You can read it in Philippians chapter 4. He said, chapter 3. He says, I have no man like-minded, for all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ. Timothy was different than all the others. There was no other one that was so faithful that would only put what was Christ ahead of everything else. And so he put Timothy there. That was the most faithful man he had. And that was the one that he put there to do that work in Ephesus. So he's teaching Timothy to commit those things of the gospel of Christ to faithful ones to teach others also. What would happen if you bring in somebody who's unfaithful and say, now go out and preach this and teach these people those things? If they're not living it, if it's not ingrained in their hearts that that is what they're living as faithful, what's going to happen? All right, how does this apply to marriage? What more important job of teaching is there for any one of us than what's going to be taught our children, our own children? Who do we want to commit those things to teach our own children? Pick somebody how faithful do we want them to be? How faithful do you want the person that's going to have more influence on your own children? How faithful do you want them to be? How strong? How much love do you want them to have for the Lord? How much do you want them to be seeking their own things rather than the things of Christ? You want anything less than the best to teach your own children? I mean, when we look at those principles, it shouldn't be a hard sell to our children about teaching them, okay, here's who you need to be looking for as a spouse and the one that's going to be raising your children with you. Don't settle. Don't settle for anybody. Don't settle for anything less than the best. What if it takes some time? We have to trust the Lord, not lean to our own understanding. Trust the Lord with all of our heart. Lean not to our own understanding. In Proverbs 3:5. A prudent wife is of the Lord. Same with a prudent husband. God's the one that provides that. If we're seeking Him, we're putting our trust in Him, and we make ourselves worthy of that and ask the Lord for that. Do we trust that He can do that? Well, that's what our children need to do. So that only the very best will be the ones that will be there teaching their children. So we can see a lot of those principles and how they apply, and we can see what happened when Solomon didn't listen. And we're going to see reverberations from this. We will see how this is going to cause problems in the future. I mean, who's going to be the next king of Judah after Solomon? Rehoboam. What's Rehoboam? What's he like spiritually? What happens to Solomon's children because of... See, there's a lot that is to come based on where Solomon goes wrong here. It has lots of consequences down the line for generations to come. And we have a bit more, of course, to look at on that before we're through with this. So we're out of time and then some this morning. But Lord willing, we'll continue on with this next week. Brother Glenn, would you lead us in prayers as we close?